that incident. From Jose Marti in Cuba, it was a direct flight to Moscow on an Aeroflot SU-151. An unremarkable event for a man carrying a legitimate passport of the Russian Federation. Alexander was able to smooth things over at Sheremetyevo, one of Moscow's four international airports, and the man had been delivered to Ivan just a few hours and a quick domestic flight later. The CIA man was now parked in a hotel suite, waiting impatiently for what was, effectively, a job interview. Oliver Gray looked at his watch, the iconic dive instrument that had influenced 1,000 knockoffs. The stainless steel case and bracelet were worn and scored by a hard lifetime's worth of use, though they had accrued before Gray took possession. The acrylic crystal was burnished by time, and the bezel and face were faded from months in the sun, a standing testament to the original owner's vocation. Behind the battered exterior, though, the hands of the precision Swiss instrument swept on, unscathed. He knew that the watch was a Rolex Submariner and that its former owner was the late Thomas Reese. What he did not know was that Tom Reese purchased it on R&R in Saigon during his first tour in Vietnam with SEAL Team 2. He'd worn it on hundreds of ops, both as a frogman and an intelligence officer, and had planned on passing it to his son James when the time was right. He never got the chance. Gray had planned his demise, outwitting the legendary CIA case officer who was far past his prime, sticking his nose where it didn't belong when he should have been fishing or playing golf or whatever it is that retired spooks do with their free time. Gray had used the watch's absence to make the murder appear to be the result of a simple mugging in a South American city well acquainted with that brand of violence. Gray hadn't killed him with his own hands. He'd instead used his Cajun pit bull, Jules Landry, who had brought him the watch as a trophy, eager to please his new boss. That was 15 years ago. Now Landry was dead, castrated and left to bleed out on a dirty floor in northern Iraq. Gray had no illusions as to where his future was headed. He knew he was firmly in James Reese's sights, and if he hoped to survive, he was going to have to strike soon before the frogmen had a chance to track him down. "He will come for me and that Syrian sniper Nizar who put a round through his SEAL friend." Gray had read all about it in the papers, how two Americans had thwarted the assassination of the U.S. president in Ukraine and saved Odessa from a chemical weapon attack at the last moment. The coup orchestrated by the late Vasily Andreyanov, Gray's Russian handler, had ended in failure. Reese had been unsuccessful in saving the Russian president, and Senior Chief Freddie Strain had been killed in the attempt. He needed to outthink James Reese before the SEAL could track him down and put a bullet in his head, or worse. Gray had no illusions about the true reason James Reese was currently in the employ of the CIA. He needed their resources to find his friend's killer. Since his former employer, and the closest thing to a father Gray had ever known, had been sent to a fiery grave, killed by one of the countless weapons with which he'd sown the seeds of revolution around the globe, Gray was now a Ronin. He needed a new master. Gray was sure that Tom Reese's son had been involved in Vasily Andreyanov's assassination, and he knew he was next on Reese's list. Gray had endured the brutal questioning from the criminal called Dmitri, as well as the excruciating overland trip taking him nearly the length of the South American continent, both only made bearable by the sweet tobacco he packed into his old billiard pipe. Add in the international flights on aging aircraft serving cheap booze, and Gray was in rough shape. They hadn't even offered him a coffee. An accountant by trade, he sought order in life, and that order was severely lacking at present. The watch was the only thing that had kept him sane, its hands moving steadily and predictably as his world became anything but. The irony was that the time wasn't even correct. He hadn't changed it since he'd left Buenos Aires. Gray was not an imposing figure, and the travel had done nothing to improve his bearing. His beard needed trimming and had turned nearly snow white over the past few months. He wore a sweat-stained wool fedora over his cap of thinning hair, and his tweed coat was badly in need of washing. He hadn't been able to bathe since he'd left Venezuela, and looked like a disheveled university professor, wearing a bitter halo of stale sweat and metabolized vodka. His appearance was in stark contrast to the spacious and orderly hotel suite. It was known as the White Suite, thanks to the snowy fabric that covered its luxurious furniture. A large, freestanding bathtub sat just feet from the rounded bed on a waxed parquet floor. What he would give for a warm bath and some sleep. His escort hadn't said a word, but had motioned for him to sit in a chair padded in white leather that faced a comfortable-looking love seat against the suite's wall. He was near the balcony and had a marvelous view of the Centralny district. Though mentally exhausted, he took comfort from being in the land of his ancestry. His plan had been to rise alongside his mentor, Colonel Vasily Andrenov, the right hand of the returning leader. Instead, because of James Reese, he was here to beg for a job from a criminal. Gray expected the security men would look like club bouncers in leather jackets, but the Vori bodyguards who protected the mob boss were clad in finely tailored business suits. The neatly groomed men could have passed for agents of the FSO, or Federal Protective Service, and in fact some of them had history in that organization. Four of them moved into the room and joined the stoic figure already watching over him. Gray was frisked for the third time, thoroughly and professionally. A few seconds later, the door opened and two more bodyguards entered, stepping aside to flank the opening. Though Gray was familiar with the details of the man who walked through the door thanks to his former duties as a senior analyst on the Russian desk at the CIA, he was not at all prepared for who entered the room. Written reports and long-lens photographs from surveillance footage only told you so much, which is why Gray had always envied the men and women on the ground who gathered human intelligence, the people who looked their subjects in the eye. Instead of an imposing figure who instilled fear, he beheld a man of slight build and of medium height. This was no tracksuit-wearing thug. Ivan Zharkov was also older than Gray expected, with a handsome face and thoughtful blue eyes. A wolf in sheep's clothing? Gray expected false bravado and swagger, but instead Zharkov walked with grace and poise. He wore a suit of thick charcoal cashmere with a burgundy silk tie knotted neatly at his throat. His beard was trimmed, his mustache purposefully bushier and more prominent. His hair had gone almost white. It was combed and parted neatly above his right eye. Gray couldn't help but think that Zharkov looked much the way Tsar Nicholas II might have looked in his 60s, had he not been shot by the Bolsheviks in a basement alongside his wife and children. His handshake was firm, and his expression was warm as he invited Gray to take a seat. It seemed somewhat odd to Gray that he wasn't offered coffee or tea, though after his journey across the globe, he wasn't quite sure if it was time for breakfast or cocktails. "Thank you so much for meeting me, Pakhan." Gray spoke first, using the Russian term for boss, and showing off his command of the Russian language that he'd spoken exclusively in his childhood home in Pennsylvania.
"It is I who should be thanking you, Mr. Gray. You have come such a long way."
"It was nothing," Gray lied.
"I was very sorry to hear about Colonel Andrenov's death. He was a friend of my business, and I know that he was like a father to you. You have my condolences."
"Thank you, Pakhan. That means a great deal to me. The colonel spoke highly of you."
"He exaggerated, I am sure. He did the country a great service by removing our president. He was a weak man who was selling us out to the Americans. I know you played a significant role in the operation. Blaming it on the Muslim savages was a touch of genius.
Gray nodded, taking credit for what had not been his idea.
What has brought you from such a warm and pleasant climate to such a cold one? You have risked a great deal by making this journey.
Oliver had practiced his pitch many times during the past weeks.
I have, Pachan.
But it will be worth it, for us both. I know the capabilities of the U.S. intelligence community. I spent my entire career using all of their tools to track and analyze Russian people of interest. I'm offering that expertise to you. The Americans trained me well, Pachan. I know everything there is to know about your rivals, about your critics in Moscow, and about the weaknesses of the Western nations' law enforcement efforts.
You have my ear, the mafia leader acknowledged.
I know where your rival organization, the Soltsevskaya Gang, is exposed, and I know which members of your organization are working with the FBI and CIA.
Zharkov spoke without shifting his eyes from Gray.
Order some breakfast for our friend here.
One of his men nodded in response and swiftly left the room.
Go on, Oliver.
The shift to his given name was not lost on the wayward spy. A hearty breakfast was rolled into the room by one of Zharkov's bodyguards within minutes, the waiter having been stopped and searched by the security men in the hallway. Zharkov took only coffee for himself, but an impressive spread of vegetables, cold meats, eggs, and pastries was presented to the famished CIA man. Gray ate quickly and drained the Bloody Mary as soon as he realized that it contained more than tomato juice. Zharkov ordered his bodyguards to keep the drinks flowing. When Gray put down his fork and took a breath, Zharkov continued the conversation.
You've promised much, Oliver, and am willing to pay a fair price for the kind of information you claim to have. My father was a grain buyer when the communists were in power. He could have rubber-stamped the purchases, but he took pride in his work and only bought the best crops. He demanded a sample from every bushel that he could inspect. I need a morsel, Oliver, a sample of your wares.
Gray was prepared for the challenge. I understand, Pachan. I have information on Melor Sokolov of the Soltsevskaya Gang. Despite appearances, he is a homosexual.
Interesting.
He's a suka, too. A bitch.
As much as that kind of behavior disgusts me, Oliver, men who have been in prison do such things. This is not shocking.
I agree, Pachan, but the man who puts him on his belly is a flight attendant for Air France. He is also an asset of DGSE. He's French intelligence. They know every move that the Soltsevskaya Gang makes and report much of it to the U.S.
Now that, Oliver, is fascinating,
Zharkov confirmed. I believe in long-term relationships, Pachan.
As do I, Oliver.
I would like to become a permanent asset to you. To your organization. Zharkov's bushy gray eyebrows arched upward before his eyes followed them to the ceiling, considering the proposal.
I must ask you, Oliver, and I hope that you will forgive me for being direct. How can I be assured that you will not betray me the way you betrayed the Americans? How can I know that this is not an elaborate ruse to put a mole inside my business?
Oliver was prepared for this as well. I will not betray you because I am Russian. My mother was Russian. My grandparents who raised me were Russian. My soul is Russian. No, I will not betray you, Pachan. Besides, where else would I go? Zharkov stared at Gray for a long moment, his eyes studying him for any hint of deception.
There was no blink, no darting of the eyes, no twitch of the tiny facial muscles. Nothing.
What do you propose?
Just a fair stipend and an apartment with a view. Zharkov considered the proposition.
20 million rubles a year and a comfortable flat in one of my buildings where you will be safe.
Gray would have taken less, but didn't want to seem overly eager. 20 million rubles was roughly $300,000 U.S. Not bad for a wanted man.
That is very generous of you, Pakhan. But there is one other thing.
Which is?
I want a man dead.
Chapter 4. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Reese settled into the cabin and put what few possessions he had into the bedroom's dresser drawers and closet. He was struck by how quiet it was. He liked it. There was no television, Wi-Fi, or cell service. The Hastings family used two-way radios to communicate on the ranch, as they were the only reliable means of staying in touch. Repeater stations placed upon various peaks and ridges ensured that one was usually in range. He opened the French doors that led toward the lake and walked toward the shoreline in the crisp, clean air. There were a pair of Adirondack chairs near a stone fire ring just feet from the water's edge. Reese took a seat and admired the view. Who would occupy the other? His pregnant wife, Lauren, and their daughter, Lucy, had been gone for almost 2 years now, murdered in their home as part of the cover-up of a deep state medical experiment gone wrong. Avenging their deaths had brought him closure. Or had it? His mission accomplished, what he hadn't expected, was to live. He'd thought he was dying, a tumor slowly killing him from within. He had counted on joining his wife and daughter in the afterlife. Africa had taught Reese to live again, but the agency had tracked him down in Mozambique, sending his old sniper school partner, Freddie Strain, to recruit him. The carrot was that he could have his life back. The stick was that those who had helped him would go down. Reese chose the carrot. He had done what was asked of him. He'd killed the terrorist leader whose attacks had put the continent of Europe under siege, as well as the former GRU colonel who had masterminded the campaign of terror in an attempt to pave the way for his triumphant return to lead Russia back from the brink. Freddie had died, saving the life of the President of the United States, taken by a sniper's bullet, a sniper who still walked free, a sniper Reese planned to kill. Reese would find him and the CIA mole who had provided the intelligence for the operation. In time, both would die. His debt to America having been paid following the events in Odessa, Reese's new boss at the CIA, Vic Rodriguez, provided a safe house in Annapolis that Reese could use while he prepared for and recovered from surgery. Vic was slowly turning up the pressure, continuing his personal recruitment efforts on the former SEAL, who remained noncommittal. Reese's friend, Katie Baranek, was like a guardian angel. She'd been by his side as he was wheeled into surgery and stood vigil while he recovered. She lived nearby in Old Town Alexandria. There she could work the D.C. Fox News desk and commute to their New York headquarters. It also allowed them to pick up where their friendship had left off. She had helped him unravel the conspiracy that launched him on his mission of vengeance, and she had paid the price, almost losing her life in the process. Unbeknownst to the former frogman, the tough young journalist had questions she needed answered. In matters of the heart, trust was paramount. Snow was falling on a morning when Katie came to see Reese after one of his physical therapy sessions. He was only a week out from surgery and would soon be leaving for Montana. Katie knew that Reese had a continued affiliation with the darkest side of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, though she hadn't probed. She'd seen a man she recognized as the head of the CIA's Special Activities Division with Reese's doctor at Walter Reed. As a journalist,